Session number 12907, Anthony Bashford, Reel 1.
Whereabouts were you born, please?
In southeast London, at Lee Green, southeast 12.
And which year was that?
In 1925.
Did you go to school in Lee Green?
Initially, the primary school, yes, and then the secondary modern school at Brockley, Brockley County Secondary Modern School.
How old were you when you left school?
15.
So by then the war had started?
The war had started, yes, yes.
Did you have any reaction to the outbreak of war?
We listened to Mr. Chamberlain's speech on our old Bakelite wireless set, and it made quite an impression, I think, at home at the time. At 15, you didn't quite realise what was happening, but having seen some of the newsreels of the Spanish Civil War, I did rather expect to see fleets of bombers coming over, but of course they didn't materialise for some time after that.
What was the effect on your family of Chamberlain's announcement?
Well, my father, who had been in the 1418 War, felt that it had to be done anyway. I was then whisked off, evacuated down to Sussex, and I only had then sporadic contact with my parents. So the initial outbreak of war was a change of home down to Sussex in a much nicer environment than we had lived in South East London, a large house which even had its own maid. Better style of food, I think, actually, even though my mother was a good cook. And south of Tunbridge Wells, so there we got on with our schooling in a large house, but without equipment at the time. Sports activities were rather overtaken by digging for victory, so we used to have to rush out and dig out the pastures and try and sow potatoes.
Well, how often did you do that?
Wednesday afternoons, as there was no playing fields or anything like that, and cross-country running was out of, not possible in view of the war situation. So we were digging for victory under the supervision of the French master, which I don't think produced any potatoes at the end of the day, but it certainly absorbed a lot of the energies of the smaller boy.
Was it done enthusiastically or reluctantly?
No, it's just a big, it's just a big lark, really. But at least it gave us an insight into country life and what lived under the soil, as far as as distinct from what lived on top of the soil.
Probably rather difficult there with all the chalk.
I remember it was very clayey. It was quite stiff soil down there, but it was a lark, really. I don't think it went on very long because of the lack of interest of small boys in not seeing the fruits of their labours come about very quickly.
You mean you didn't have to do it?
We didn't have to do it, no. I think we rather tended then on a Wednesday afternoon to slope away or probably get on with our homework to leave a weekend free.
How was the evacuation carried out? What was the process?
We all assembled at Ladywell Station near Lewisham in London with a case with belongings and a large luggage label on our jacket. Waved goodbye to our mums, got on board. It was a steam train and off it went, but nobody knew where it was going to. Even the masters didn't seem to know. And it went westwards towards Reading, and the masters assumed we were going to Berkshire. But then it seemed to turn south, and after a much longer journey, we ended up at Wadhurst Station, south of Tunbridge Wells, where we then marched from the station into the Memorial Hall, and various foster parents came along to take us home.
What was the mood of the children? Was it tearful or enthusiastic or what?
No, it's just like, I think it felt like a day's outing without the realisation it's going to last for much longer than a day.
When did it happen?
It happened on the day before the first siren went off, so it must have happened about the 2nd of September, because on our second day down at Wadhurst, my friend and I were walking across a field and we heard the siren go. And this, I remember, was a false alarm at the time. The first siren was a false alarm. But we did both look up expecting the sky to be darkened with aeroplanes, and it wasn't. So we went on picking blackberries and eventually got home, or got back to the foster billet. The foster billet was not a very satisfactory situation insofar as the couple who had taken us in were quite old. They were well up in their 60s. And they couldn't quite cope with us, and they only had a farmer's cottage which didn't have adequate washing arrangements. And when after 3 or 4 weeks we were thinking that we should have a bath, it took quite a long time for them to empty the bath of the vegetables too, and to get the geyser to work to get some hot water in. And when we did get in the bath, of course, we played with the earwigs that were floating around on the surface of the water. And that billet only lasted, I think, for 2 or 3 months, because my mother, who came down to see me, was unhappy with it. It wasn't the fault of the people. They had rather overstretched their resources, being elderly. So we then had a transfer from Wadhurst to Ticehurst, and that was when we arrived in this very comfortable billet, it was called. The head of the household was the local builder and undertaker. And as a temporary basis, we kept our two bicycles in the mortuary. And one day, when we came back from school to put our bicycles in the mortuary, there happened to be a newly made coffin in there, which, with a smell of resinous wood, and not knowing whether there's somebody in the coffin, we weren't too sure whether we could park our bicycles in the mortuary or leave them outside. But that was a very kind, exceptionally kind house. There was the householders, Mr. and Mrs. Starting, who had with them their married daughter and granddaughter, who was about 19, evacuated from London. Their son-in-law was still working in London. And there was a lot of activity at the time in Sussex. The Canadian Army was moving about in large convoys. The local defence volunteers were very busy. The house and the garden in which we were billeted had a rather commanding view looking south out of Ticehurst towards Hawkshurst and the south coast. And this was assumed to be a line of advance of the German army. So the Home Guard made a little defensive position at the end of the garden to have a commanding view of the road. We weren't allowed to go near this because it's thought to be a state secret at the time. But anyway, it went on, the war went on. I used to cycle from Ticehurst back to see my mother in southeast London on the Saturday and then come back on the Sunday. That was quite a long ride in those days. But then she developed cancer, and I had managed to take my O-levels a year early. So I decided to leave school at 15 and went back to live with my parents in southeast London. That, of course, was the time of the start of the Blitz, when we spent long hours lying underneath the kitchen dresser and covered by the stout kitchen table during the night as the Luftwaffe went above their business overhead.
How frightening was it?
Well, it's quite frightening, yes. But if you had the proximity of your parents, that was the comfort.
Well, couldn't you have used a proper shelter?
The Anderson shelter, which had been down the garden, was flooded and could never be drained of water. But in the latter stage of before my mother died, we did have a Morrison shelter that was put into the kitchen, which was psychologically more comforting, but a terrible nuisance. It took up the whole of the kitchen floor, but it was turned into a table, and I think it served its purpose.
What was the difference between a Morrison and an Anderson shelter?
The Anderson shelter was outside in the garden, semi-dug into the ground with an earth covering. But the Morrison shelter was a steel, flat, plated cage about 3 feet in height that was erected inside the house. So the Morrison shelter formed then the table, the main kitchen table, but was very angular, being steel, and you were knocking your knees on it, not very comfortable.
Was there much destruction in the area where you lived, in Lea Green?
Well, quite a lot, yes. My mother at that time, although she had cancer, was working in the local police station in the canteen. And it was always a problem, actually, whether she'd ever get home. Anyway.
What was your address in Lea Green?
Oh, 6 Effingham Road. Lea Green, South East 12. But anyway, Mother did always get home eventually, but she died of cancer. And that was...
Do you remember any particular buildings or streets that were hit in your area? Any particular bombs that created an especial impression?
Not in the immediate area, because I think it was, I suppose, the smaller size bombs. It was a bit... We had no landmines in that area. I did, after my mother died, and I was working then in London, I joined the Home Guard unit that was guarding Sharmeg's house and the Petroleum Board and that area of the Strand. And one night on Home Guard duty, luckily being inside Sharmeg's house, there was a landmine that came down and landed in the embankment gardens that caused, of course, a very big hole. And in fact, if you walk past the southern side of Sharmeg's house, you still see the scars on the masonry on the outside. The landmine itself had the effect of blowing down all the inner walls of Sharmeg's house, rather than the outer stone walls. But that was the largest bomb that I saw, because soon after that, of course, I went in the army, and that was before the V2s and or V1s and V2s came.
Did this Home Guard unit have a number or name?
I can only remember its company. It was the D Company, and I can't remember the actual regimental unit. But D Company was based in Sharmeg's house. And in Sharmeg's house at that time was the Petroleum Board. And the Petroleum Board was the directing organisation for getting oil supplies into the UK. So, and the oil Petroleum Board was made up of all of the chairmen of the large oil companies. So the duty, I suppose, of D Company, whichever Home Guard unit it was to try and preserve Sharmeg's house and the Petroleum Board from parachute attack. So Home Guard duty was quite a change, actually.
How did you come to be a member of that Home Guard rather than one in Lea Green?
Because that was where I was working, in Sharmeg's house at the time. I suppose really I was the private pike of that unit.
Which one's that?
Well, Private Pike is the lad in Dad's Army on television.
Oh, played by Ian Lavender.
Played by Ian Lavender, yes. Mm. So, yes, I was the youngest one at that time. Being rather tall, I think I got in because I was a bit underage, but tall enough to, stand up with the rest of them. The rest of them in that Home Guard unit obviously were from the Corps of Commissionaires, who were 14-18 war servicemen, and the middle-aged men who were in reserved occupations, as they were in the petroleum industry. So I was in the Home Guard unit there for, I suppose, 9 months.
Which year would that have been?
1942.
Did you have a uniform?
Oh, yes. Yes, a uniform, yes.
Just like a regular army uniform?
Just like regular army uniform, yes, exactly.
But Home Guard insignia?
Just Home Guard here with some
on your shoulder.
Some formation sign on the arm. And of course one left one uniform at work because I went home obviously each night, but on the night you're on Home Guard duty you changed at 5 o'clock in the evening. Home Guard duty was quite pleasant in the respect that one had a free supper and a free breakfast in the restaurant. And with the shortage of food, of course, that was quite pleasant because the food preparation was quite nice. I quite enjoyed Home Guard suppers and Home Guard breakfasts.
But not lunch?
Well, lunch came in the working day. But, so this was only overnight duty. So the duty then was to patrol up and down Victoria Embankment, I think looking for paratroopers if they came. We had various exercises. Lincoln's Inn Fields, that was a bit to the east of Shelmack's house, had quite a lot of bomb damage, and that damaged area was used for Home Guard exercises, scrambling in and out of the debris. So evenings were spent in exercise, either scrambling over the bomb debris or getting familiar with the Lee Enfield rifle. And also we did have one rather curious Lewis machine gun, which was the pride and joy of the unit, except that there wasn't a lot of ammunition to use with it, so we could drill with it but not actually go away to fire it. Anyway, Home Guard duty came and went,
How effective do you think your Home Guard unit might have been if the Germans had invaded?
Not very effective, because lack of firepower, and they themselves were not very physically active. I mean, they were old people, or they were middle-aged people, but not really physically fit. And apart from myself at the age of 17 and a half, I don't think overall they'd have... But morale was good, and I think the people who were doing it, people who were in the Home Guard, the older population, I think it lifted their morale enormously.
What was the attitude towards the Germans on the part of the Home Guard members at that time? Was it one of hatred or not?
It was more of hatred because of the effect of the Blitz on the civilian population, and it was thought that the Germans weren't playing it fair, that it wasn't a man-to-man fight, it was more that they were fighting against civilians. I think, having said that, of course, we only came to realise later that possibly we ourselves did more in that respect to them than they did to us. But morale was high.
How much do you think you learned from the Home Guard from the military point of view?
Just enough that when I did go into the army, and I went into what was called a young soldiers battalion, so that everybody was just on the age of 18, I felt slightly more familiar with the foot drill than some of the others, but the military preparedness was not very high.
So you were conscripted into the army, were you?
I volunteered actually for the Royal Armoured Corps.
Why did you volunteer?
It seemed to be a job that had to be done. And as I couldn't get into the Air Force, they wouldn't take me into the Air Training Corps. I thought the next best thing, rather than being a foot slogger, was to join the Royal Armoured Corps. I haven't got the impression that it was safer to be inside a tank, I think, than not be inside a tank. But that was a very inexperienced expression, or didn't last very long, or that impression. So most of the young soldiers' battalion were in fact volunteers. And of course, being volunteers, they're all very keen. So the 58th Young Soldiers Training Battalion at Bovington was quite keen to get on with the training and to join the service unit.
Can you tell me about some of the aspects of the training that you did?
The initial 6 weeks was one of square bashing. The initial 6 weeks was simply learning drill and becoming proficient at drill, with training in rifle drill and using the brain gun. The initial 6 weeks, well, at least the initial training should have lasted 6 weeks. For me it lasted a bit longer because the army decided that I was underweight for my height. And they sent me and two other young lads to a physical development centre at Kingston-on-Thames. And the physical development centre at Kingston-on-Thames was designed to increase your weight, I think. But it didn't have that effect with me because I think I didn't end up any lighter, but I certainly didn't end up any heavier, because most of that further 6 weeks physical development training was in running along the towpath at Kingston-on-Thames in full battle order, which didn't increase weight, but it did increase and in fact gave one a lot of stamina. And I think that from the primary training in the army, the one thing that I was always grateful for was that it gave me a physical stamina which I might never have developed for myself.
Were you undernourished in any way?
No, not at home, no. But the army had a fairly fixed height to weight ratio scale, and they rather felt that the physique was not sufficient. So the training, the physical training, which was quite, I found, very extensive. There's a lot of, say, forced marching in full battle order around Richmond Park and along the towpath, a lot of gymnastics, a lot of track running, but with no other military training. But for 6 weeks physical training, I'm quite sure that it did me a lot of good.
Were there any people at this physical development centre who were undernourished?
They didn't look it. In fact, if one looks at the photograph, they all look fairly well physiqued. So I formed the impression that it was the Army Physical Training Corps who were sort of trying to fill their job in a bit. I can show you the photograph of these. They don't look undernourished at all. But that was quite I wouldn't say an enjoyable 6 weeks, because one felt that slightly miffed that one had been chosen and picked out to have one's physique developed. One felt a bit sort of self-conscious about it. But anyway, after 6 weeks, we, the three of us, returned to Bovington and were reabsorbed into the next training stream.
What about the mechanical side of getting used to the armoured vehicles?
Well, that was after your initial 6 weeks primary training, you then went into the actual Bovington armoured vehicle training camp. You then had tuition in gunnery, wireless and driving. And as this progressed, your instructors streamed you into whether they thought you were going to be a driver mechanic or a wireless operator or a gunner. And I don't think my driving ability in those days was thought to be very good, so they decided I'd be a gunner operator. The gunnery was sparse in terms of firing anything live. It was all right in terms of weapon cleaning and weapon stripping, but I can only remember ever firing the 75mm gun on a Sherman with two rounds, both of which I think missed the target and disappeared out over Lulworth Cove into the channel. At the end of your training period, you were given a choice of which fighting unit you would wish to go to. And I, coming from London, but not knowing much about the cavalry or other armoured units in the army, thought I'd join the 3rd County of London Yeomanry, the sharpshooters. So I applied to join them and arrived down at Worthing to join them after they had returned from Italy, at the time that they were waterproofing their new Sherman tanks. So I think I had 6 or 8 weeks at Worthing on waterproofing the tanks before we then set off out of Worthing to go down to Portsmouth area.
So the name of the 3rd County of London Yeomanry is the Sharpshooters?
The Sharpshooters, yes. Yes.
Does that go back a long way?
I think it does, as a yeomanry regiment. And there's more than one County of London yeomanry regiment. There were more than, I think there were two battalions of the 3rd, and certainly there was the 4th battalion of the County of London yeomanry.
Can you tell me what Sherman tanks were like to be in, to work in, to operate?
They were, well, it's cramped. If you have five people in a single tank, it's cramped. But the Sherman, unfortunately, was high. And that was one of its disadvantages. Of course, it stuck up in the Normandy and other landscapes a bit too high. And it's high because its drive shaft went from the rear to the front instead of being driven where the motive power was. But to be in the turret of a tank is something that you get used to. It's alternately very hot or it can be very cold. You get used to it. You eat and sleep in there. You have to do everything in there. If you're confined at long periods. Certainly in Normandy, when there was a lot of holding action and we were ridge squatting at the time, that is, you were on the lee of a commanding ridge and you were just waiting under fairly constant mortar attack, waiting in case the Germans attacked. But you couldn't get out of the tank for